Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I'm reading from the bio, brief bio of my honored and honorable guest today. It begins. When I was 6 years old, New York City's child welfare system took me from my foster parents and sent me to one of Bellevue Hospital's psychiatric wards. There, as a part of an experimental group of eventually several hundred children, I was given a course of 20 shock treatments by one of the leading child psychiatrists of her day. And I'm putting in parentheses, yes, you heard correctly, 6 years old, 20 shock treatments. I was then shipped to a state hospital where I spent the rest of my childhood. Why, by the way, he ended up staying there so long is an interesting story in itself. Again, continuing with my guest's brief bio, released at age 17, I went on to work my way through college, graduating with honors. Later, I served two stints in psychology graduate programs, but fortunately, he writes, it didn't take. Eventually, I became a patient rights attorney and am still an active member of the California State Bar. I found out about what we then called the Mental Patients Liberation Movement in 1971 and have been active ever since in several cities in the U.S. and Canada. Really, I would put parentheses, he's worldwide. I'm most proud of the campaign I led in my hometown, Berkeley, that persuaded our voters to ban shock treatment here. That, of course, was overturned, but by the courts, protested by the shockers, the psychiatrists, the state of California. But it is a grand moment in the history of psychiatric reform when the lights went out in the shock room and shock stopped briefly as a result of protests. Ted's a little younger than I am, and he ends up saying that he's rededicating himself to all I can do so that what was done to me won't happen to others. Now, just before I introduce you to Ted Chabasinski, let me remind you, it's about 9 days to our conference at Michigan State. It starts on Friday, goes through Saturday, and then half day Sunday. It's the best conference Ginger and I have ever put on. It's in collaboration with Bert Caron, amazing psychologist, really a dean of intelligence and reform and psychology. It's on the campus of Michigan State University, the great Kellogg Center and Hotel. It's a really nice place. And we're going to start Friday with a lot of really good people. I'm hoping you'll all come for Friday. I'm going to do a lot of talking on Friday, and we're going to give you a free dinner just for getting there on Friday. You can look it up on my website, Bregan.com. You can look up the conference on empathictherapy.org, Bregan.com or empathictherapy.org. And now, Ted, are you there?
I am.
And, of course, I didn't mention the reason why I thought of having Ted on right now, he's been on before, is he is helping to sponsor an international day. What is it, May 6th?
May 16th, we're having an international day of protest in about, let's see, we've got, I think, five other countries and, of course, the United States.
Well, go on and tell us about that, the kinds of things I want to cover today are the conference, are the protest and your story and shock treatment in general. And Ted, I've just finished a blog that I hope to put up on Madness in America that will help promote your conference. And I got a new video up that's coming up today, hopefully, about ECT to go along with it. So now I give it totally over to you. And why don't you just talk for a time about the protests that are developing?
Sure. This kind of happened spontaneously. As some of you might know, one of our most respected leaders, Leonard Frank, who had received many, many shock treatments, and it took him years to regain his old self. He died recently, and there was a lot of discussion about what we could do to memorialize him. And one idea people came up with was having multiple demonstrations about shock. Now, Leonard was one of the founders of the Network Against Psychiatric Assault in San Francisco, which did a great job in the 70s. They managed to stop shock treatment completely in San Francisco for a while, not by having a vote of the people, but simply because the hospitals got very tired of the multiple demonstrations that Leonard and his co-worker, Wade Hudson, who are co-founders of NAPA, were leading, and so they just didn't want the bad publicity. So St. Mary's Hospital and Langley Porter both just stopped doing it because of the bad PR. But anyway, it's now 2015. We're not in the 70s. But this just took off like wildfire, and there's a woman in Portland, Deborah Schwarzkopf, another shock survivor, who had already planning a demonstration for May 16th, and suddenly everybody wanted to join in. And we're expecting about 24 demonstrations. Let's see, we have two in England, two in Canada, maybe three. We have something in New Zealand. We have, amazingly enough, something in Uruguay. And I forget the other English-speaking country. I don't know why I'm spacing it out. But we have
Australia, I hope.
No, unfortunately, there's nothing going to happen in Australia. We have one person in Melbourne, and she's going to hand out leaflets on that day. But I don't think we could count that as a demonstration. I'm trying to find other people in Melbourne to help her. But right now, in fact, Australia is a very fertile ground for this because they do lots of shock, and they even do a lot of shock on toddlers. Toddlers. Just unbelievable. And they're just running wild in Australia. There has been things in the past there, but I don't think that's a very active movement there now. But anyway, we have about perhaps 18 or 19. I don't have the figures in front of me. They change every day. 18 or 19 cities in the United States and about 14 or 15 states. We're going to have something in two in California. There's going to be two in New York State, and an especially interesting two of them in New York City on the same day. Very interesting thing they have planned there. And basically, we're hoping to put this issue right back on the map. I mean, I've been told by, I have to brag about it a little bit, I'm in touch with somebody who's doing a video for the New York Times, and she thinks the idea of 20, 25 simultaneous demonstrations is pretty impressive. And I'm just starting to work on the publicity now in other places, but I think having, you know, 20, 25 demonstrations at the same time is pretty impressive. And I hope we're going to start bringing to the attention of the public just what an outrage this is. I mean, it's not, I said it in 1982 and we banned it in Berkeley, and it's still true today. Shock treatment isn't really a medical issue. It's a moral issue. It's a human rights issue. I mean, all you have to do to find out what shock treatment means is ask the people who've had it. Now, there's a lot of nonsense that issues from the American Psychiatric Association and the shock doctors in general about how, oh, everybody gets their opinion about shock treatment from the movie One Flew Out of the Cuckoo's Nest, but it's been tremendously improved and everybody benefits and blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't need to see the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen it to know what shock treatment is really about, although I will say, based on the film clips I've seen, that the portrayal in the movie is quite accurate, actually. And it's still used as punishment in some places, but mainly it's used because it brings in a lot. I saw an amazing thing. Mainly it's used because it brings in a lot of money to the shock doctors in the hospital. You know, I saw the figure of, and I'm not vouching for this, but I saw a figure of $50,000 per treatment. That's because the government and the insurance companies pay for this. And ultimately, everybody pays for it because that raises the cost of health care all around. But this isn't health care. This is just a money-making enterprise for the people who do this, for people who really don't care about what happens to their patients. And what I want to do here, I want people to realize that this is the true face of psychiatry, with the exception, of course, of people like you, Peter. And I'm not saying there are not other decent psychiatrists in the field, but as a whole, the profession of psychiatry is just morally bankrupt. And I think that shock everybody, you know, the average person on the street, their first reaction when I bring up the issue of shock treatment, they say, and they said this 33 years ago, they say, shock treatment? You mean they're still doing it? Because everybody assumes it's not done anymore, that it's some outrage, some terrible thing from the past. It's an outrage and it's terrible, but it's not from the past. They've kept right on doing it. It's very difficult to tell how much shock treatment is being done because the shock industry has managed to get laws that were on the books, off the books. That is, California, as a result of a lot of reforms that were pushed through by the Network Against Psychiatric Assault, had a reporting requirement. Where, you know, we knew who was doing it, we knew how many shocks were being done, we knew, I think the last time we had the information, 2,500 people a year were getting it. And now they managed to slip it through, get rid of it. And I just was talking recently to a woman in England who's going to be putting on one of our demonstrations in London, and I asked her how many people were getting it in the United Kingdom, and she said she couldn't find out either, because they used to be a legal requirement, and somehow that was done away with. You know, it's not hard for them to tell you how many procedures they do. I mean, if they're doing, for instance, appendectomies, they can press a button and come up with, we did, you know, 17 appendectomies a month, or we did so many heart surgeries a month. Obviously, they keep records, but they don't want people to know about this. But the generally accepted estimate is that 100,000 people a year get shock treatment in the United States.
Ted, I think it's more than that. That estimate is mine from 1979.
Oh, really?
In my book, Electroshock. It's a first and only medical book against shock treatment. And I had pretty good data then. We had some Texas data then. We had some California data. And my experience, and you go back that far too, my experience is there's quite a bit more being done now. I think it's doubled. I would push it to 200,000 or more. And I think that's why they're hiding the data.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, the thing is, they don't want the public to know there's many, many shock treatments being done. It's very lucrative for them. It's lucrative for the hospital. It's good for everybody except for the people who get it. And, you know, even in Texas, where there's a lot of pressure on, you know, Texas actually has the most advanced laws about shock treatment, the most firm informed consent laws, although they can get around them. And even there, I've seen several newspaper articles saying the incidence of shock treatment is increasing in Texas. It's an unlikely place, I know. Texas isn't known for its human rights record, but that is true. But nonetheless, more and more people are getting it. And again, I think that it's important for people to realize that it's not... Well, and there's other things that are in conjunction with it. For instance, the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual has been a big uproar about what they came out with last year, where there used to be something they called, and correct me on this, Peter, the grief exclusion, was it? Where,
yes.
Where, yeah, so what they got rid of that. You know, I won't explain what it was, but I'll tell you what it is. That now, if someone close to you dies, or if you're grieving over something, you have 15 days to get over it. Now, think about that. Think about the worldview that can even promote that. Let's say you're like an 80-year-old woman, and I say woman for a reason, because women are twice as likely as men to get shock to. But let's say you're 80 years old, and your husband that you've been with for 55 years dies. Now, you're supposed to forget about this person in 15 days, or you're mentally ill. Think about that. Those who are listening to this program that are a bit skeptical of the very critical attitude towards psychiatry that it expresses, think about that. First of all, do you think you could get over something like that in 15 days? And second of all, what kind of view of the world would promote that? Think about that. I don't think the average psychiatrist is at a very high level of moral integrity, and this is an example. And now I've read, and I don't even really understand it yet, they're pushing in even more, and again, you can fill us in on this, Peter, an even more detailed description of this supposed clinical depression, whatever that means, if you take too long to get over something like this. Do you think the psychiatrists take more than 15 days? Perhaps they don't. Maybe that's the problem here. But I can tell you when people have died, I mean, my friend Leonard has been dead for, 2 months, and I still miss him, and I'm going to miss him for years. My first wife, who was my comrade in this movement, died 5 years ago, and I still wish that I could call Judy up and run things by her. We were friends till she died, even though our marriage broke up, but our friendship certainly didn't. Was I supposed to just forget about her in 15 days? I'm meeting, well, never mind that. But this is a concept that's inhuman. I mean, it's just unbelievable that anyone would promote this. But the problem is, see, that the average person has been, the drug companies who pretty much own the psychiatric profession have put literally millions of dollars into public relations for psychiatry, and people have been kind of convinced that somehow when they have emotional problems or troubles with living, and I'm not denying that there's something a lot more serious with some people than just emotional problems, but you don't go, if you go to a psychiatrist to get help, you simply don't. I mean, people have come to think that when they have a problem, they go to a psychiatrist, but what happens when people try to come up with a better solution, a better help, the profession of psychiatry fights it tooth and nail. There was a psychiatrist, Lauren Mojo, who I greatly respected. He died about 5-6 years ago. And he had a very high position in the psychiatric profession. He was chief of schizophrenia studies with the National Institute of Mental Health. But he was thinking, these drugs don't seem to work to help these people with this description of schizophrenia, and I'm going to start something which he called Soteria House. I'm going to start something where people will just be protected and given emotional support and allowed to go through their emotional distress with a lot of support. They won't be drugged. And the results were better than the usual way of treating people, which was to stick them in a locked ward and pump them full of drugs. Well, you would think this man would get the Nobel Prize or something, wouldn't you? I mean, he invents something where people aren't drugged, they get better, they're not abused. Well, what happened to Lauren Mosier is that he was driven out of his job with the NIMH. And he was lucky he didn't get driven out of the profession, although I think that would have been harder to do. But that's what psychiatry does. It's not that they're the only people that have help to offer. And I could go on and on about the bizarre way they respond. One of the things they talk about is stigma. Now, let me see if I can explain this because it's so irrational here. They say when people like me say that, you know, other folks have been through what I've been through, shouldn't be drugged, shouldn't be shocked, should be treated with respect. They say that I'm stigmatizing these people. Now, that is the most, I am one of these people, but somehow I'm stigmatizing these people because I'm saying that the marvelous help, I'm being sarcastic, that they're getting, and I'm preventing them from getting help, so therefore I'm working against their interests. Now, if you didn't have all these millions of dollars worth of publicity from the, basically the drug companies, the average person would listen to this and say, that doesn't make any sense. Well, it doesn't make any sense. But what we're dealing with here is a first of all, the drug companies really own the profession of psychiatry in the United States. They spend more money, the drug companies spend more money promoting the drugs than they do researching them. And they're not very well researched either. For instance, let's take, and I know I'm going away from the topic of shock treatment, but they're all bound together. Let's take antidepressants, for instance. When you do real studies of them, there's a psychologist named Erwin Kirsch who wrote a book called The Emperor's New Drugs. And when he did some careful research, he discovered that there was basically no difference between placebos, you know, inert, non-drug pills or whatever, and the antidepressants. There was a very slight difference in favor of the placebos. When he gave people what's called an active placebo, more than a sugar pill, but something that would give them some side effects, so they thought they were getting a real drug, you had the same percentage of people reporting that they were feeling better. Now, there's something more dangerous just that these things don't work. And a good number of people, and we have something very current now going on here, and a good number of people, they lead to suicide, and they lead, even worse, to homicidal impulses. Now, let's take this very recent horrible incident of this young man who apparently did have some problems with depression, taking the plane he was piloting, locking out the captain, and crashing this plane with 150 people into it, into the French Alps. And all, of course, those 150 people died. And now we have, the usual line about this is, oh, if he only had gotten psychiatric help, this would have never happened. Well, of course, it's a little difficult to say that since he was getting psychiatric, quote-unquote, help. And what he was also getting, it's quite clear, was antidepressants. Now, the people who knew him said they were just kind of amazed. He just wasn't this kind of a person. He certainly didn't go around talking about killing people. It's very obvious to anybody who knows the trajectory of these things that he was on antidepressants. And the FDA in the United States, which is hardly known as a bunch of anti-drug radicals, I mean, they don't protect the public very much, but one of the official effects or so-called side effects of most of the antidepressants is homicidal impulses. So you're giving people, and of course this doesn't happen to everyone, it may very well be a small percentage, but if you just have one person even in 10,000 who takes antidepressants who has who experiences homicidal impulses, that's 100 people to the million. And you have tens of millions of people in this country taking antidepressants. I threw out a figure of 40 million in an article I recently wrote on Mad in America. So if you multiply that out, you have 4,000 people, and probably a lot more because 1 in 10,000 is a very low estimate, 4,000 people having homicidal impulses. Now, some people still have enough self-control not to carry them out. But do you really think it's a benefit to society to give people drugs that don't work, that make them want to kill people or kill themselves? This is utter nonsense. And yet another thing people should consider, since the Second World War, there's been a huge increase in the number of people who have come under psychiatric treatment. Psychiatry holds itself out as, you know, protecting society for all this mental illness. Well, that sounds nice, you know, but the problem is, The more people that have psychiatric treatment, the worse things get. And that's been happening over the years. Now, there's a very honorable and honest journalist named Robert Whitaker who wrote a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic. And he traced the increase in drugging and the number of people who wind up on the welfare rolls for mental illness. And he found that the amount of drugging and the amount of people winding up on the welfare rolls went hand in hand. They were very highly correlated. Now, do you really believe that this profession is helpful when it creates more and more people that have quote-unquote mental illness? I mean, if I said I have a cure for Ebola, put it in my hands, right? We have a few cases of Ebola in the United States. So you put it in my hands, and I give them the latest wonder drug, whatever it is. And 2 years later, we go from 500 cases of Ebola to 5 million cases of Ebola. Would you take me seriously? Would you say I should be given more and more public funds to continue to treat people with my miracle cure for Ebola when what I've been doing has created more and more sick people? Well, that's exactly what psychiatry does. I would highly recommend, by the way, Bob Whitaker's book, and he's coming out with another one called Psychiatry Under the Influence, and people listening to this program who want to learn more about the truth about psychiatry, I'd follow Peter's books, of course, but I'd get a hold of Bob Whitaker's book. He started out believing in this stuff. He was looking into psychiatric drugs, and he believed, like everyone else, that, you know, there were miracle cures and great progress is being made and blah, blah, blah. But he's an honest guy, and he didn't help his career by saying, hey, this isn't the way it is.
Ted, so, let me sure. break in a minute. We're going to go to break in about 3 minutes. I'm really glad to have you unraveling all of this for our listeners. And I want to put in, because I'm very proud of my own efforts in regard to ECT. I believe I was the first psychiatrist ever to go out on a limb and publicly stand up on the ECT issue. And you mentioned something I didn't know, which is back in 1971 and two era that they temporarily stopped doing shock in San Francisco.
Yes.
I was involved in that, though. Maybe you and I even met there, because I testified, and I think you probably did too, at the San Francisco Supervisors Committee public meeting about ECT.
I may not have been in San Francisco at that time. In fact, I think I wasn't. I think that when they stopped, it wasn't 71, it was a little later. I think it was in 70. It might have been 75, because I was
a few years later than that, yes.
Yeah, I was living in Washington State, so I wasn't there firsthand.
Probably 73, 74, somewhere in there.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, so I also, you know, you mentioned that Texas has the better laws, and I testified there, too, in at their hearings. You know, I paid my way to these things and testified at the Texas hearings. I don't think I was the largest force there by any means. You have John Breeding in Texas. You had Leonard Frank in California, and they were leading all of this. But I do want to associate myself with this movement, literally going back to the early 70s. And I've continued to just stand up on these issues. And finally, you know, the first lawsuit we ever won against a shock doc, and a doc who referred his patient for shock treatment, I was the expert in that. So, I mean, one is that I'm proud of it as an activity that I've been doing for many, many decades. And the other side of it is how few psychiatrists have taken any stand on this. We have two or three now, maybe, Dan Fisher, who have begun to speak out occasionally, but no one's ever devoted himself to saying to his colleagues, you know, you guys got to stop this. And one of the things that I think goes on, and this is going out in a limb a little, you mentioned the money issue that drives the shock doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I also think they're driven by violence. Human beings, we're a very violent bunch of people. We are just terribly violent. I talk about that in a lot of my new book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And human beings find ways in whatever civilization they're in to be violent, whether they go into the 16th century priesthood or 17th century priesthood and become, doctors who become, in effect, witch doctors chasing witches, or whether they become psychiatrists who participate in lobotomies and give electroshock. And the response of shock doctors to any criticism, which is why I think no one before me spoke out, the response is very, very violent from them. So I think that we're not only dealing here with money and power, we're dealing with about the only area in the country in our civilization where you can wear a suit and really be violent to people. I don't know what you think about that, but I really do think that's part of the issue. We're talking with Ted Chabaczynski. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'm hoping Ted will talk something about how did a six-year-old get shock treatment, and even more astonishing, how did he recover from that and growing up in a state mental hospital and become the moral activist that he began? A little late, we go to break. And this is Peter Bregan with my wonderful guest, Ted Chabaczynski, a wonderful, wonderful man. And just for 10 seconds, reminding you, through my website or through empathictherapy.org, through Bregan.com or empathictherapy.org, you can still sign up for what I think is the best conference Ginger and I have ever put on. It's on Michigan State campus. It's just in 9 days from now, 17, 18, 19. It's real easy to fly into or bus into East Lansing because it's a big university town. And we're just going to have the most interesting audience we've ever had. Wait to see some of the people. It will shock you. I'm not going to tell you, but it will shock you to see the whole new group of people that is now getting determined to do something about psychiatric abuse and to offer better alternatives. And I give the mic now back to my old friend. We don't exactly correspond on a regular basis, but my old friend, Ted. Hi, Ted.
Hi. You wanted me to talk about my own experience, but before I do that, I just want to backtrack on a couple of things that you were saying. First of all, my first contact, well, not personal contact, but my first knowledge of Peter was he was speaking out against these proposals to basically lobotomize these kids that were rioting in Southern California, and he stuck his neck out fighting that. I was just amazed that any psychiatrist would speak out against that. And I was thinking when I heard him on the radio, I heard him, I think, on WBAI in New York, you know, one of the Pacifica stations. I thought, that man's going to lose his license. But he didn't, thank God, and he's with us now. And then I also want to say something about what Peter said about, the thirst for violence that some of these people have. And I would say that's true, too. And I think it really shows the complete lack of concern for the people they're supposed to be caring for. And you have to ask what kind of profession recruits people like this. Also, and I think it's kind of related too, I've heard about, I'm not really a therapist, I'm a lawyer, but I heard about Peter's, empathic therapy, and I didn't quite understand exactly what the point was. And then I realized that's what the psychiatric profession doesn't have. It doesn't have empathy. How anybody could do shock treatment to people and then not think about what the effect was. I mean, it's just, what sort of moral numbness is going on there? And, I know people might have difficulty dealing with this, but if you have a profession that does, 98% harm to people and very little help, you have to ask, who's running the show? What are these people doing? So I know people listening to this program are probably already kind of convinced, but I just think people should think about that. What kind of people do this sort of thing? Now, about my own personal experience.
Let me insert something briefly about those kind of people.
Yes.
In a recent suit that I was involved in California, I found out that I hadn't read the law in a long time, that the law requires that doctors who do shock treatment report any memory loss to the state that they see within some period of time, I don't remember, maybe 2 or 3 months after shock treatment. Mm-hmm. And none gets reported because the doctors now don't follow up.
No,
so they don't have to report.
I think you're right.
That's scheming.
Yes, and I think you're right. And you're actually giving me some thoughts about strategy here, because I do think we can reinstate the reporting requirement and all that. These are small reforms, but they would be helpful, especially the memory loss, since the psychiatrists deny it. But everybody has memory loss. I'm friends with this woman who had 66 shock treatments. She can't remember her children. I asked her once very recently about, well, it's not important what it was about. It was about, you know, babies, because I've been touched recently. A friend of mine's granddaughter just had a baby. And I asked her a question about weight gain with newborns, and she said, well, I don't know, because she can't remember. She was a nurse for 25 years. It was her childhood dream to be a nurse. She can't practice that anymore. And the worst thing of all is, if you ask her something that happened 2 hours ago, she often can't remember. She can't set memories very well. Somehow she functions, and she's a very somebody who really should be. It makes me cry just to think about it, that this fine, decent person had to go through this, you know. But anyway, I think that it's a good idea. You're putting some strategy in my mind here. It's a rather small kind of reform, but I think we do have the ability in California to push for it, and that would be interesting.
Well,
I'm putting that in the back of my mind as something we actually can do. About my own experience, if you want me to go on with that.
Yes, please.
My mother was labeled as schizophrenic, and now I don't know if I believe in the label of schizophrenia, but I do believe people have, you know, mental problems that are pretty severe. And I met her later in my life when I was 16, and she definitely had a lot of problems. And she was admitted to Brooklyn State Hospital in 1936, the year before I was born. And a year later, I was born. She was 27 or so, and she didn't feel she could take care of me, and she probably couldn't. So she put me in something called the New York Foundling Hospital, which is part of the city's child so-called welfare system. And they placed me with a foster family, and which is kind of unusual now, because now when they say foster children, they mean kids in institutions. But I was put in a genuine foster home. And in retrospect, I think they were really nice people. You know, they weren't rich, and they weren't well-educated, and they didn't legally have any parental rights, because it's a long story, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on that a long time ago. And that means that when Dr. Loretta Bender, the doctor who gave me these shock treatments, was looking for experimental subjects, the New York City Child Welfare Department turned me over to her. And my foster parents didn't want me to go. I had a very moving confrontation with my foster father when I was 20 years old that I wrote about in my in-process autobiography. And I never realized what had happened. I said that you sent me to that place. And he broke down and cried. This is a man, a working-class guy, cab driver. I'd never seen him cry. And he said, no, Agnes, that was my foster mother, Agnes and I didn't want you to go, but they said you had to go, and there was nothing we could do about it. You see, I was lied to. They said that my foster parents put me there. But basically, because of my mother's label, and there was a very, very strong contention at that time that schizophrenia was inherited. There were twin studies that had basically been debunked by a guy named Jay Joseph, actually. I should mention his name. And so basically the idea was, well, I had inherited schizophrenia, right? And so now I was a pretty normal kid. I was just kind of shy. I was also a very bright kid. And I remember I went through kindergarten, all the way through kindergarten. But when I got to first grade, I was so advanced that they just put me in they promoted me to the 3B, it was called, the second half of third grade, where I sat in the back of the room and read fifth-grade books until the teacher had a question. And then, you know, like if you give the man, you buy two oranges at 5 cents a piece and you give the man a quarter, how much change do you get? And I just look up from my book and say 15 cents and go back to my book. I was a very bright kid, but Dr. Bender actually wrote that high intelligence was a sign of mental illness. Think about that. And so I got 20 shock treatments. Oh, and then, of course, the theory that schizophrenia is inherited, it's very easy to prove. You just take the children of so-called schizophrenics and diagnose them as schizophrenic. There's nothing to it. But I was just a shy kid, and my mental illness, according to them, consisted of things like I used to love making mud pies in the backyard. And I loved, it was kind of scientific in a way. I would try different mixtures of dirt and water to get the right texture so that the mud pie would set or it wouldn't fall apart. I still do this. I like to cook, and I play with ingredients that way. Well, this was a symptom of my mental illness. And I used to, there was a, on my way to the candy store that I used to go to, there was a sort of a vacant lot where a lot of older children played, and they discovered that if they threatened me, I'd get scared and run away and leave my tricycle there. Well, of course I would. If I was 6 years old and 12-year-olds threatened me, of course I'd be scared. Well, this was a symptom of my mental illness, too. And as we know now with the DSM-5, which I think bears lots of mentioning, anything you do is mental illness. If your kid talks back, they have oppositional defiant disorder. If they're bored in class, they have ADHD. If they act like children, they're mentally ill. And so everybody can be diagnosed. But they didn't have it then. They just had total power over me because my foster parents couldn't do anything. They labeled me as schizophrenic. They sent me to Bellevue to get shock treatment. It was a horrifying experience. Along with the shock treatment, I was repeatedly raped by one of the staff. And I don't know how come I remember a lot of this stuff, but I do think that actually children actually have less brain damage from the shock. But I remember telling my foster father about being raped, and he's very concerned. He went to talk to the doctor, and he came back saying, "The doctor says you imagined it." Well, you know, he was an uneducated man. He couldn't do anything about it anyway. But I imagined it, and I felt very betrayed by my foster father. Well, of course, now I know he did what he could, you know. But I imagined this. And I think you have that a lot when you have brutality in these places now, that anything people have to say is completely dismissed. I mean, imagine you're a woman in a psych ward and you're raped and you think you can call up the police and report the rape. And you're calling from ex mental institution. How do you think you'll be believed? Of course not. That's why a lot of this brutality doesn't get checked. But anyway, I had the 20 shock treatments, and I left Bellevue in May of 1944. My seventh birthday had been in March 44. And when I got back, I couldn't remember my way around the neighborhood. I remember that really scared. At first, I just clung to my mother. I was just so frightened and beaten down. And then I remember there was this little boy who lived about two houses away from us. I can take you to that very corner. His name was Carl. But I didn't remember him. So the social worker who came to visit every month or so said, "This is a sign of my mental illness, that I couldn't remember this." Well, of course, it was a sign of a shock treatment. And then what really bothered me, I used to have this tricycle. I used to love to ride my tricycle. And I lived in a little part of the Bronx in New York City called Woodlawn. It's a little neighborhood right on the north central boundary of New York City, and it's only about a half mile square. It's quite small. And I knew just about every block, and you know, they had certain boundaries. There's a cemetery on one side and a big park on another, and one of the main busy streets in the next city up, Yonkers, and a huge busy street. I guess that would have been in the south of it. So it was pretty much, you know, pretty bounded, and I knew every place to go there. And when I finally felt not scared enough that I could get on my tricycle and ride, and I just took off very confidently because I always knew where to find my way, and suddenly I realized I was lost and I didn't know where I was. And so some kind neighbor, I guess they must have known me, and they took me back home. And this was reported to the social worker, who said it was a symptom of my illness and I wasn't getting better. And so in October of 1944, I was 7.5 years old. I was sent to Rockland State Hospital, and I spent the rest of my childhood there. Now, in a certain sense, I was lucky because you have this now. You have children put in these places, and they get put on psychiatric drugs, and they're left on psychiatric drugs their whole childhood. And besides the physical effect on their brain, God knows what that is, you know, they have a growing brain that's numbed out by these drugs, it also keeps you from absorbing experience. You see, you're kind of in a fog, so you hardly know what's going on. Now, in spite of the bad conditions around me, I wasn't in a fog, and I did pay attention to what was going on. And one part of my character now is that I'm a very independent thinker, and I always investigate everything before I form an opinion. And most people don't, actually, because it's a lot easier to just accept what's all around you, whatever the conventional wisdom is. But I knew that if I accepted what I was being told, I'd be doomed. I mean, I would have never gotten out of there. And because I wasn't drugged, I was still able to think for myself. And so I survived Rockland State Hospital. I got out in April 1954. I was 1 month past being 17. I was lucky because just 2 or 3 months later, in June or July of 1954, just about every inmate of the state hospital in the United States was being put on Thorazine and Stelazine, one of the first of the so-called antipsychotics. In fact, I was on what they called convalescent status, which is really like a parole for somebody who's been in prison. And I had to see this psychiatrist every month. And my foster father brought me there, and the psychiatrist said, "We have this wonderful new drug, so why don't you give it to your schizophrenic son?" Of course, I was hardly schizophrenic, but they pay no attention to what's in front of them, right? You have a label, you're crazy. And we left, and my foster father said, "Teddy, do you want to take this drug?" And I said, "No, of course not." And he said, "Okay." And fortunately, they didn't come after me with tanks the way they did to that poor woman in Michigan a year ago or so when she didn't want to put her daughter on these antipsychotics. And they actually sent a SWAT team with a tank. Marianne Godboldo, her name was, a SWAT team with a tank to force her to put her child on drugs. Unbelievable, isn't it? But it's got lots of publicity. It's quite true. Anyway, there I was, and I'm 17 years old, and I had my first contact with an agency that really helped me over the years. Twice I've been connected with the vocational rehab programs. And in this case, I wanted an education. I was a very smart kid, and I was self-educated. I read just about every book in the Rockland State Hospital library, anything I could get my hands on. And so I got connected with vocational rehab, and this guy had some contacts with a couple of colleges. In fact, he actually got me admitted to an Ivy League school, Columbia University, but I couldn't go because they didn't have any evening programs and I had no way of paying for it otherwise. So in about a year or two, I began at New York University, in a regular program. I did have to take a course in high school geometry because I'd never studied that on my own. So I'm 19 years old. I'm supposed to be this, you know, total crazy who's going to be totally crazy for the rest of my life. And I'm studying away in college and working at the same time. In fact, at some point I had 3 jobs and I was going to school at the same time. I had to drop one of the jobs. It was too much. So I'm working my way through school and college 2 years after I get out of Rockland State Hospital. Meanwhile, Dr. Bender is writing, you know, that I'm a total wreck. Now, why she wants to say that, since she claims everybody's benefited from electroshock, I really don't know. I know that when I was in, about my early 30s, she was saying that I was still dependent on foster homes and blah, blah, blah. And what I actually was doing was teaching psychology in a little college in Brooklyn and, of course, living on my own and married.
Where was she saying that, in a scientific article?
One of these, I think, great strides in child psychiatry. I need Leonard Frank with me because he knew all that stuff. He showed me one of the articles. I also was told this by Richard Cohen, this fine filmmaker who made a film called Hurried Tomorrow about conditions at the State Hospital in L.A. and made a film called 41 Days about the Berkeley shock ban. And he quoted from this article where she was saying that I was dependent on foster homes in a totally hopeless case. Meanwhile, I'm married and teaching college and working on getting my PhD, which I unfortunately never got, but I did get a degree in law, which I still I'm
you know, Ted, I would think she'd want to claim she cured you.
I know, but you see, you can say anything when you're a psychiatrist. I know, it makes no sense whatsoever.
No sense at all.
It makes no sense at all. And then, of course, when you're doing research, you have some kind of objective measure, right? And so, you know, let's say you really believe in shock treatment. You give a whole bunch of people shock treatment. And then you find some objective measure of, you know, in what ways are they better? I mean, there's many things you can do. But Dr. Bender's idea of a measure was, well, I spoke to a lot of people, and they're all in agreement that these kids are doing much better now. That was the summary of what she said. And unfortunately, a lot of psychiatric so-called research is like that. But getting back to me, there I am. I'm 19 years old. I'm working my way through college.
We've got about 4 minutes.
Okay, well, I just want to say, though, that it's still going on with children. You have a lot of that going on in Australia, which you can't do too much about. It's happening in New York State, and there's a fellow named George Ebert who's going to be addressing it on May 16th, who's a very great organizer there. And now, the NIMH has just given $400 million to do so-called research on the brain, but given what psychiatric research looks like, they put this all in the hands of a great shock treatment advocate. And if anybody wants to make a bet with me about this, I predict that in about a year there's going to be an announcement that some of this $400 million has, they've done research with it that shows conclusively that shock is 100% effective and has no side effects. I mean, this is imagine it's more than a waste of taxpayers' money. There's not going to be any objective research done here. And that's just, and it's going to be, and they're pushing it for, at the University of Iowa, they're pushing shock treatment for children. In New York State, I'm not exactly sure where, they're pushing shock treatment for children. So not a whole lot has changed, although some states, including California, I think Texas, have banned shock for kids under 16.
Yeah. But we have an article out that I did with, I was like a third or fourth author. I just helped out on the science on the shocking of children that folks can find on my website.
Came
out in Childhood and Society. We're talking with Ted Chabasinski. Ted, we're finishing up now. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you? The best way to find out about the protests? And of course, I'm going to try to do a blog on Mad in America about it in the next day. But what's
great.
The best way to get in touch with you?
Well, I've set up a separate email account for this event, and it's May 16th Shock Demo, all one word. May 16, you know, the number is not spelled out. May 16 Shock Demo at gmail.com. And I'm set up to answer these kind of questions. So if you're interested, I don't want to give out my phone number over the air.
That's
you can
fine.
Also, you can also write to me at Ted Chabasinski. If you go to Mad in America, they have a way for you to contact people who write for them. Click on that in the upper right-hand corner and put in my name, and you will be able to write to my personal email if you want to do that. I hope to hear from some people and. Thank you very much for having me on the show, Peter.
I admire you enormously. I think the point you made that you survived all this because they didn't give you drugs, and you just escaped because you got out of the hospital in 54, and that's when the drugs came in.
Yep.
And that's, by the way, the same year that I started volunteering at the Harvard Radcliffe Mental Hospital Program. Oh, my Lord.
You were pretty young then. You're not much older than me. I was only 17 then. You must have been
a kid. Yeah, well, I was 18.
I thought so, yeah.
I'm a year
old. Us old guys still have good things to accomplish.
Well, I think that the work we do has been kind to us in many ways. As difficult as it is, it's been kind to us.
I think so too.
Real pleasure to have you on the show. I wish you the very, very best with your May 16th protests around the country.
Yes.
And folks in my listening audience, this is the last time I get to say it, because the conference is next week. Come to the conference. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 17th,
where?
The 18th, and 19th, in East Lansing, Michigan.
Oh.
You can find us on Bregan.com, and you can find it on empathictherapy.org. I'd love people to come up to me and shake my hand and say, I heard about it on your radio show. And meanwhile, I love this show. I love having the opportunity to talk to my audience. I love PRN. Thank you, PRN. And goodbye now to all of you. And Ted, we'll stay in touch.
Yes, definitely. Thank you very much, Peter. Goodbye.
Bye-bye now.